The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 425 on the podcast today. Penny stock millionaire Timothy Sykes. If you've not heard of this guy, check him out. He's turned $12,000 into $4.3 million. And we chat about his strategy and also his aim of creating millionaire students. Also on the podcast, Strategic Minerals, that's SML ticker. Managing Director and CEO John Peters answers listener questions. And it's worth a listen here. The share price has dropped recently. And John is suggesting there's good value. And I sort of tend to agree with him at this level, you know. Also, a company worth putting on your watch list, I'd say. Now, the ticker is TLOU, but it's pronounced Clow, as in cloud, without a D, apparently, in Botswana. But you'd say it Clow. So TLOU Energy. I'll get Finance Director Colin Clonan on. He talks about TLOU's principal asset in Botswana, where it's one of the first and most advanced coal bed methane projects in southern Africa.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is a guy that comes highly recommended. Listeners of the podcast will have heard of Big Gib, one of the most popular podcasts I've ever done. And he said to me, do you know Timothy Sykes? I said, no, don't know him. He said, get him on. And Timothy, thanks for coming on, fella.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm just going to read the first line of your bio on your Twitter feed here. And it says, I've turned $12,000 into... This is phenomenal. $4.3 million. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a good start. You know, I'm still young. I'm just getting warmed up.
Yeah. Well, how old are you, Tim?
I'm 34.
Wow. So when you had 12,000, how old were you then?
I was 18.
Wow. Wasn't that bar mitzvah money, apparently?
Yeah, it was bar mitzvah money. You know, now I trade with a smaller account in order to teach. So you won't see me going to like 20, 30 million anytime soon. I love working with people and helping people with small accounts so that they can turn, you know, a few thousand into a few million. My top student has turned 1,500 into 2.7 million in 4 years. That's where I think there's a lot of opportunity that Wall Street doesn't really think of, because frankly, you know, a few million dollars on Wall Street is nothing, even though to 99.9% of the world, they would love to have a few million dollars.
Yeah. So when you first started off, when you were 18, I mean, did you start in small cap stocks?
Yeah. You know, I've always found this niche useful. I guess when I first started, I tried investing in big companies and my $12,000 just wasn't moving. So I gravitated towards lower price stocks. They're more speculative. They're very inefficiently priced, and I saw a lot of opportunity there.
Okay, and when you first started in penny stocks, I mean, did you find it? Did you take the water straight away, or did you? I mean, because I've obviously tried to trade and it's very hard. Or did you make some big mistakes?
I mean, I was in the right place at the right time when I first got started back in 1999. Pretty much any penny stock I bought would surge. I've always kind of sold too soon. So if I was in a penny stock and it was going to like double or triple, I'd only take profits of like 20 or 30%. Like even today, right before this, I just gave a webinar. I actually short sell penny stocks. Like you can bet against kind of pump and dumps that have been featured in like Wolf of Wall Street and Boiler Room type stocks. And so the stock is down, 20, 25% on the day, but I made like 13% on my money. So I take the meat of the move. That's what I aim for.
Okay. And do you mainly short or do you also go long?
I go both. You know, there's a lot of penny stock scams that I love just betting against because they all pretty much end up at zero. But then there are some quality small cap names that, you know, have decent earnings and they actually sign big contracts with big companies and they have the potential to go up for a few weeks or months before they eventually screw it up. You know, the key to remember is that most penny stock companies fail eventually, whether they try or whether they're just outright scams. So you kind of know the end game, which I think is the big advantage. You know, if you're trading Google, Facebook, Amazon, you know, these big companies, you don't know how they're actually going to do in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Like they might be well, they might be bad, but with penny stocks, you know that they're pretty much going to fail. So you can kind of work your way back from, okay, this is obviously going to fail. How is it going to fail? And so you can make money on the way up, but you have to understand that, you know, any gains in most penny stocks are probably going to be short-lived.
Yeah, do you know what? It's very interesting because, like I said, the podcast, I mean, it's very popular amongst small cap, investors, traders. And I've done both, large cap, small cap. But I want to get that, early, sort of a company that will make it big. But do you think that's a waste of time trying to do that?
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants to find the next Microsoft. And I mean, there are examples. If you look at like Jazz Pharmaceuticals, I was trading it when it was a penny stock, and now it's, nearly a $10 billion company. So there are some, but to try and find those, it's so near impossible. The odds and the statistics say, why not just wait for some penny stock to spike big, 100, 200, 300%. And if the fundamentals aren't, truly there, you bet against it. And it'll probably crash 30, 40, 50, 60% in a day or two when the crash comes, especially if it's promoted Wolf of Wall Street style via telemarketing and email promotions. So that's what I really focus on. That's my bread and butter.
Do you know what? It makes so much sense because, I'm in my Twitter there. There's always guys saying, I'm in this. And, you see a penny stock go through the roof, a couple of 100%. And most people are saying, they're jealous, they missed out. But you realize if you're going to short it, you haven't missed out. In fact, you're looking for the spike and then jumping on top, which is the right thing. It makes sense, actually, complete sense, doesn't it?
It's pretty logical. It's just tough to bring logic in a game like penny stocks where there's so many degenerate addicts just looking for action. It's kind of like if you go to Vegas and you look at the people playing the penny slots and, they just want to win the jackpot and they ignore stats, they ignore math, they ignore, everything, and they just believe the hype. So for me, it's about trying to bring rational, logical, statistically backed thinking into a game that's just full of people who want to play like the lotto.
Okay. And have you sort of in any way assigned a formula to what you do, or is it pretty much each trade is a different animal?
Yeah, I mean, I take it one trade at a time. I mean, every pump and dump pretty much collapses, very quickly. Like once the promotion emails stop or the boiler room telemarketing phone calls stop, these stocks do crash 30, 40, 50, 60, 100% in like a week. So you can pretty much look for when a pump and dump, starts crashing. It's usually not going to come back. But with companies that I'm like buying earnings winners, where, the penny stock has reported better than expected earnings and, maybe they're growing faster, like a small company like MeetMe that I was buying in the ones and now it's in the threes, that's not as exact because you're betting on kind of like the inefficiency that I mentioned earlier, where a company has good news and it's not fully priced in on day one or day two. If Google or any big company, GE, reports good news, 1,000 different analysts, all different news services pick it up that instant. With penny stocks, if let's say a small company has a big licensing deal, it doesn't get picked up until day two or day three. Because most news wires, most traders don't want to trade low price stocks. So you have a little bit of a time inefficiency that you can take advantage of.
Yeah. And yourself, there, do you actually, it's all about sort of risk reward there. Do you have a certain amount of percentage gain you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, even if I'm in a stock that's going to double or triple, I'm always taking 20, 30% profits. I don't aim for home runs. If you want to make a baseball comparison, I go for singles, lots of singles. That's how I made my millions. That's how my millionaire students have made their millions. Going for home runs leads to strikeouts. And sadly, that defines most people who trade small caps. They're like, oh, this company had a great technology, but this happened. Oh, this was such a great product, but this, something always happens. Okay. So you have to kind of try and think, you make a comparison to horse betting, right? Like if you're betting on a horse race, you have the favorites and then you have like the 49 or 50 to one long shots, and everyone loves betting on the long shots, but it's exciting, but you're probably going to lose. So for me, I like, looking at the odds and I like looking at risk reward. So if I'm up 10, 20, 30%, I take it every time. And if it keeps going, I don't mind. I took my profits. The same thing with losses. I don't let small mistakes turn into disasters. sometimes I'm wrong. You know, sometimes I'm betting against a pump and dump and it just keeps getting pumped and I have to lose 5%, sometimes 8%. But I don't let my losses turn into 10, 20, 30% losses. So I'm actually like the most cowardly conservative penny stock trader you'll ever meet.
Okay, well, it's obviously working. But what I like, though, is that I've watched a couple of your videos, and in some of them, you are obviously brash, out there, showing your cash. I saw a presentation where you threw a Rolex on the floor. I don't want this Rolex. But what I like about that is not just bragging about the money. You are now, and I assume you're getting, you know, a good feeling from teaching other people. Is that right?
100%. I love teaching. You know, my best-selling DVD now is all for charity. I started my own charity foundation, and now I've donated over seven figures to charity. You know, I didn't expect it, okay? I got into teaching partially to make money, partially because I saw there was so much information out there, but I did not anticipate how fulfilling it was or would be. So I wasn't there when my first millionaire student passed $1 million, but I was there when my second millionaire student passed $1 million in profits. And, you know, this is a guy who had $1,500 to his name. So I, you know, I can't take all credit for him. He did the trades, he learned the strategy, but by my putting him on the right track, you know, when he tried on his own, he was on the wrong track. And that's why he sought out my help. And that's why, you know, sadly, most people seek out my help. They're investing in one of these penny stock scams, and then the stock tanks 70, 80, 90, 100%. Then they start Googling around and they see a blog post I wrote maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago warning them that they never saw before. So for me, it's about getting good information out there and, you know, really just helping show people what I've seen in over 16 years of trading, you know, because I'm totally self-taught, and that sucks because I still make boneheaded mistakes. So I try to be the mentor to people that I never had.
Yeah, that's nice. You know, there are people out there who probably have messed around in the penny stock game and have lost more money than they've earned. But it's a hope there that you can, you know, do as well as you've done, because you're one of these guys that most people want to be. Are there any students out there now you've had that are equally in your success yet?
Yeah, you know, Tim Grittani, 1,500.7 million in 4 years. I only was up to 1.7 million years. So the fact that, you know, other people are turning a few thousand into a few million, I know it sounds crazy, I know it sounds unbelievable, but we show every trade. You know, I win roughly 70% of the time. I think he wins roughly 70% of the time. You know, we trade somewhat different patterns. But, you know, it's just about taking it one trade at a time and seeing how it adds up over time. You know, you don't see us make $1 million on any one trade. We make a few thousand here or there. We aim small, miss small, and then, you know, move on to the next play. And the cool thing with penny stocks is there's always another play. There's always another new technology being hyped. So you just have to kind of understand the forces that work and, you know, try and profit from it.
Yeah. So if you could give one, you know, sort of lesson to someone listening now who's struggling in the penny stock world, what would it be, Tim?
Sure. I would say ignore hype and press releases, you know, about some new amazing product or some CEO promise. Ignore all of that and focus on price action. So you might not think an earnings report is necessarily good, like the numbers aren't that great or they have losses, but maybe the CEO on the conference call said, hey, you know, we have a new product coming out, you know, next quarter, or we're getting really good feedback on this new product or something. So whatever the news is, don't care specifically about, you know, what caused the run up. Focus on looking for big percent gainers. So I always look for big percent gainers every single day. And then I work my way backwards. What caused the big percent gain? Because you don't have to be first with any penny stock. You don't have to discover some story. You don't have to discover some technology. Usually, if you're first, it's actually worse because no one else really knows of it, and you might wait, you know, 6 months or even 2 years, or, you know, no one will ever care about this. So for me, I like to piggyback moves that are already happening and then look, what is the catalyst? What is the news that caused it? And does this catalyst or news have legs? Like if there's a new product or a new licensing deal, as opposed to, you know, some of the big percent gainers I see, it's up because, you know, someone paid $500,000 to send out an email blast to promote this company. That would be a negative catalyst that I would not want to buy because that would be temporary. So for me, I want to see a big percent gain first, and I want to see some news that has legs before I buy. And, you know, when I'm shorting, I want to see a big percent gain. And obviously, you know, when a stock is being promoted via newsletter or telemarketing, once the promotion dollars run out, it's going to fall off a cliff. So that's when I'm looking to short sell.
Okay. And as far as you're concerned now, what's your goal, Timothy, now?
More millionaire students. You know, I'm very honored by having a few, but I'm even more honored that my millionaire students also help me teach. Like, I give one webinar that's live per week. I just gave one this morning and I made like $2,000 during the live webinar. That was cool. But now my millionaire students also give webinars and they want to give back because they're, frankly, you know, they understand how tough this game is. You know, most traders lose money. So it's all about sharing good information that we've learned in our own personal experiences, and you know, slowly but surely we're creating more millionaires and turning the tide, because you know, frankly, when I got started teaching, most people thought you should never trade a penny stock, you should never believe in this, you know, junk, and there's no way to short sell it, and so we're just trying to get good information out there that's worked for us.
Marvelous. Well, Tim, it's lovely to talk to you, fella, and I would love to get some of your students on as well, just, you know, to tell us how they started, how they found you, and how well they're doing. But I'd urge people now listening to go to timothysykes.com, and I'll also put your link there to Twitter, which is @TimothySykes on my website. Tim, lovely to speak to you.
Thank you, man. Yeah, and I'll definitely tell my students to hit you up and, you know, hear from their perspective. It's all about getting, you know, good, honest people and their experiences out there. It helps everybody in this game.
Thanks, Tim. Speak soon.
Thank you, sir.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Peters, Managing Director and CEO of Strategic Minerals. SML is the ticker. John, thanks for joining me. I know you're the other side of the world. It's quite late where you are, so I appreciate you staying up, because I think it's about 11 p.m. there. And to me, that's very late, because I got up very early in the morning. So thanks very much, John.
That's all right, mate, and it's always good to speak to you, Justin. Mate, it's worth staying up just to talk to you.
Thanks very much. Flattery will get you everywhere. Right, so let's for people who are not aware of Strategic Minerals, can you take us through what you're about, please, John, quickly?
Yes, look, we look at minerals across the whole board. We've got an operations. We're trying to focus mainly on operations, but the market conditions at the moment have led us to consider all investment opportunities a bit more open. But we're built around having an operating offtake mine in New Mexico, the Cobre mine, and that provides us an underlying cash flow, and we build ourselves off that to look for investment opportunities.
Okay, all right. Well, let's go through. I submitted a link to Twitter, and some private investors have submitted some questions. So first and foremost, question number one. Currently, how much cash do you have in the bank?
Well, I find this a really funny question. I've already put out my RNS that I've got $1,048,000 US in the bank. This is the 31st of December. So this is a figure that must appear in my annual report, or the auditors will have me.
So
there's been a lot of Twitter comment recently about us having no money, which has been basically false. We've actually had this. We've had people set up dummy websites, etc., etc., and we've basically taken the view that we are not going to waste our shareholders' resources fighting people like this, because they can just go off and set up again another day. There is so much rubbish going out, it's not funny. We have money in the bank. We haven't gone out. We haven't wasted any of the money that we've done. We undertook our analysis of Tartu conditions changed. We took the brave decision to cut it there and then, because we did not want to waste the resources of our shareholders. We've trimmed our overheads. Like everything, we're very, very careful on what we spend our money on, miserly by what a lot of people say. And that is why. But I cannot understand why you would doubt the fact that we've put in $1,048,000. I will say there are some costs of Tartu that haven't been paid yet in that cash figure, and that will come out in the next quarter. But that then will be reflected in next quarter's numbers as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a period between reporting where investors hear nothing, they start to get worried and start to believe rumours, and, a bit of patience sometimes is needed. Okay, so the next question is a follow-on from that. How long will that cash last?
Okay, well, there's two questions to this. At the moment, I've done my forecasting of not only what's in there as cash, but also we've outlined that we're planning to drill associated with the nickel sulphide deposits in Central Australian Rare Earths Proprietary Limited, CARE as I'll call it from here on in, including the drilling, that money will last through. We are also then trimming back our overheads. I've taken a pay cut. I've put my CFO onto consulting rates. We're basically the only two full-time employees apart from those that operate Cobra Mine, which are within their own expenses from that the mine. And once we do that, we believe we can get all our overheads, including those of being listed, which are quite significant between Nomads and PR and auditing and the and having to have to pay fees to the exchange. We can get all of that underneath the amount generated from Cobra. So basically that means that that money lasts forever unless we put it into a project. And yeah. What we really want to do is keep our company such that, unlike a lot of other minnow miners like ourselves, etc., or operators, we don't need to go to the market for working capital. We go to the market for project-specific funding.
Okay, all right. Well, that's good. That covers the next question, really. It says, are you considering a placing? So I suppose you've covered that there, haven't you?
Well, the only time we consider placing, and we've done one, since I've been in charge, we've done one placing. That placing was related to a project. As it's turned out, the project hasn't gone the full way, and that's the way these things occur. But we've tried to adopt a policy, which we're trying to stick to, that we keep our overheads underneath enough so that when we go to the market, it's got to be project specific. At the moment, I don't have any plans for that. But if there is a project that's good enough to warrant that, then we will go to the market.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's the three biggies out of the way. Cash is king, as we know, and that's covered that also. Next question. Why did you believe there was sufficient local demand in New Zealand for tattoo coal before dropping it?
Okay. There's a couple of areas with that. There was a couple of local ones that we were quite happy that they thought that we thought we'd be able to supply them for. And the truth is, what's happened has been a combination of questioning whether we're going to have enough demand locally in New Zealand, and also their prices coming down a bit. Right now, those prices coming down have come across the whole world, so that's had a slight effect. It's been less of an effect there, but it's enough to start to make between some slightly lower volumes and the price to make the project marginal. Now, I still haven't answered your question, so I'd like to do that, okay? And that is, we had a couple of people who indicated also that maybe the sulphur that we were finding in the deposit might cause a problem. We had to then, if we were to go ahead, we had to spend a fair bit of money to do more drilling to show them that wasn't the case. And then that became very marginal and questionable if it was worthwhile.
Okay, all right. And there's a supplementary question there. So should you have dropped tattoos sooner, knowing how poor the coal space was, and concentrated elsewhere?
Okay, we stopped our work on Tatu almost immediately, or not immediately, but soon after we were informed as to the drilling results and understood the need to spend a reasonably large amount of money still just to prove on the resource. And after, at the same time, I think there's about a week or two difference, and that was because we then tested some of the market people that we were expecting to get with that knowledge as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Next question. When can the nickel project start to deliver revenues?
Okay. The nickel project isn't likely to deliver revenues in the shorter term. Why I was attracted to the nickel program, and I do say that this is a little bit different to what our policy was before, and I do state that in today's release, and that is the nickel program will drill and then establish a value of a resource. In that area, there are several large nickel producers, and that we believe that if we drill and show the resources there, we are likely to be able to some sort of arrangement with the local people so that there is a chance to improve the value of that asset, either realise it or go into some sort of a farming arrangement with some larger players, but to increase the value for our shareholders within the year sort of thing.
Okay, all right. Next question is, are you looking at any exciting projects, i.e. gold is in vogue right now?
Yeah, everyone says, I think I've had about 80% of my shareholders email me asking when we're doing gold. And I've looked at a couple of gold things, but again, we also get a bit hamstrung by the fact that we're listed on AIM, and if we go into projects that are too large vis-a-vis our market capitalization or our assets, then we get into what they call a reverse takeover situation, and then we have to make or produce a document that is effectively like a prospectus, and therefore we have to spend in the order of £250,000. So, you know, that's not something I'd want to do unless it was very, very strong. And that would involve all our shareholders, and it would also involve us being suspended on the exchange. All of that means that you can't just walk in and say, okay, I'll do this gold project at, you know, £10 million, because you just can't do it. You've got to, that's why you will note that many of the projects we've been trying to do have involved us making payments that are related to the future cash flows. And that's one way that we can try to get transactions that are appropriate. The other thing which I, you know, and I've made this comment before and I will still make it, we're not on our own in being, you know, the whole sector's being looked down upon at the moment, which is fair enough. But what that also means is that there are a lot of minnow miners or people with resources that are good resources that just won't have cash flow in 6 months' time and won't be able to stay listed and won't be able to do this and that. So we believe we're probably going to be, because of the cash flows from Cobre, because we're tight on our overheads, of course we've got some money in the bank, we believe we'll be in a position where there will become opportunities and there will be things that we can do. I mean, we can look at mergers, we can look at script acquisitions, etc., if the price is high enough and the target is low enough. Our share price is high enough and the target's low enough.
Today's RNS states that there was a history of derailments and go slow on the line. Why were none of these reported to the market at the time under AIM rules?
Well, to begin with, when that occurred was about 3 years ago.
Okay.
So, one, I can't record it because I wasn't even involved with the company at that point in time, although I did help to set up that original railroad contract. These occurred when we were shipping the major shipments out, when they shipped about $34 million worth of magnetite out of Cobre. And they were using the railway down to the port of Guaymas in Mexico and then off to China. At the time, when, as a condition of getting access to the iron ore, the magnetite, a condition was that we had to upgrade the railroad spur up to Cobre Mine. And the company spent over $3 million US in doing that. But the contract for that also stipulated that had to be of a quality that would allow the movement of the 1.5 million tonnes of magnetite that we had there by rail over a two-year period. Now, we don't necessarily believe that that was the quality that occurred. There were a number of derailments and there was a go slow where at points where locomotives were only allowed to go 10 miles an hour, on the line. And we had a lot of trouble with them providing us carriages and a few other things. All of that is currently being looked at. We expect, we've been in negotiations with them, with people about it. We're now taking it to the next stage. As always, we'll monitor it. We'll make an assessment as to whether it's worthwhile to go to the next stage. And we'll continue our negotiations on that basis.
Yeah, and you mentioned there that there may be compensation. Someone said, how much compensation could you get from the railroad claim associated with Cobre?
Who knows? Honestly, as I said to you, we've expended over $3 million. Are we going to get anything back? I can't tell you for certain, but because it is such a large number and it is associated with the company, I felt it best to disclose what was going on.
Yeah. Okay. Next question is James Chisholm going to play a more proactive role?
For those who know James, James has been fairly tied up lately with a lot of what's been going on with Atrum, where he has a large amount of his own personal wealth tied up into it. And James has indicated an interest in becoming more actively involved and possibly taking a board position. At the moment, we haven't confirmed whether that will or will not occur.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Why hasn't any of the directors bought shares at this level?
Okay. Firstly, until even today, I don't think it's possible that we could have bought shares because of about ready to make a release about the quarterly update. In particular, mm-hmm. there's information in there about the amount of tonnage we've shipped at Cobra, et cetera, et cetera. Individually, the directors have their own responsibilities. Anyone who's been following this stock for a long time knows that I have personally heavily supported the stock itself. And surprise, surprise, I'm not an undying will, so I can't necessarily keep putting money into the company either.
Yeah, okay. And the last question here is, what is the probability of a merger or RTO or takeover of SML now?
Mate, I've had people tell me that there's going to be a takeover. People talk about mergers. Again, everything comes down to what's the best value for the shareholders. As far as I'm concerned, whatever the best value for the shareholders is, that is what we should be doing. What I do feel at the moment is I feel the stock is grossly, and I think partly this may have been done on purpose, but I think the stock is grossly underpriced, particularly when you consider that we're turning over currently we're turning over about 1.2 million at Cobra, and we're clearing about 50% of that to profit prior to overheads. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, tell me where you're going to pick up a shell that does that anywhere in the thing, and I'll tell you won't.
Yeah.
So it should be trading at a more of a premium. Now, it's also a stock that isn't that, while it trades a bit, it's not that thick in trading. So if you want to try and play around with it, of course you can try and play around with it. And I think some people might be trying to do that, getting ready to make some sort of an offer. If they do, well, then we've got to assess what it is on the merits. Mergers, I've looked at mergers associated with other people with reasonable assets. It might be a thing because here we are. We're at the moment a company that's got a good cash flow but not necessarily a big asset for an upside on. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Naturally, I've been looking at whether that could combine with people who are listed already to try to get away with two of the overhead costs, cut it down to one. And also, I think the trouble I tend to find is that when I try to do most of that, I'm going to run into this reverse takeover requirement problem.
Yeah, just looking. I mean, market cap is, you know, just under a million. Like I say, you got cash there of a million in December, and you got revenue.
Well, just be careful. Market cap's just under a million. Well, actually, probably about a million in pounds now.
That's right, yes. And,
but we've got a million in US dollars.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, good to point that out. And but like I say, you got revenue there, and you know, you're turning over. So okay, well, listen. The thing is, those questions were quite hard because at the moment, like, the share price is taking a bit of a hammering, and you get private investor concerns, and they voice those. So that's why the questions are hard. But what they do is try and cover off the negatives, which is quite good, I think. But you know, John, let's have three reasons why someone should put, you know, strategic minerals on their watch list, and let's have a redress there from the positive side.
Okay, well, look, plain and simple. As I just mentioned, we're one of the few companies that has an operating business that's providing a cash flow to maintain the business, right? Secondly, we've got a management that's shown that it's committed to keeping its overheads under that so that we can continue on. Thirdly, we're seeing opportunities arise, and we've got a management team together now that's shown that it can move that on and find opportunities such as the nickel sulfide project that will, we hope, provide short-term upswing in shareholder benefit.
Marvellous stuff. Well, thanks for coming on, Dominic. It's late there. You can go to bed now and rest assured you've covered off every shareholder concerned. So, John,
well,
thanks very much,
pal. Well, I wish that went through, Justin, but you and I know that won't be the case. But
no, I know.
As we've said, I've said it, and I appreciate your show is very well received. But as I've said all along, it might not always be what you want to hear, but I'm going to tell you the truth. And the truth is what we've just said.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, I'm looking at that thinking it's a good value at the moment. You know, that's what I'm thinking. Obviously, if you're a shareholder that's bought up a bit higher, then obviously there's concerns of always. But there you go. But, John, thanks for coming on, fella, and do come on again when you have future news.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Finance Director. I'm going to say the company, but Colm, I'll ask you to say it. By the way, it's Colm Clunan. Thanks for joining me, Colm.
Thank you, Justin. Yes, the name of the company is in Setswana, the Botswana dialect. It's called Claw Energy, and Claw means elephant in Setswana. So a bit of a difficult one to pronounce, but... We like the emblem, and the elephant represents sort of the big game, and we see ourselves as the big play in Botswana.
Yeah, so my first take on it was Tlou Energy, which and luckily the ticker code is TLOU, so if anyone wants to look that up, it'll also be on the website, but it's TLOU. Okay, Colm, well, listen, go through a broad outline as to what you do there, Colm.
So what we are is a coal bed methane company focused on delivering energy to Botswana and the Southern African region via our gas assets in Botswana, which are located in the Kalahari Desert. The area we work on, we call it the Lesedi Project. We've been working there for a number of years. We have a quite advanced project, significantly de-risked. We have a huge database of wells in the area. We flowed our first gas back in 2014, and we're currently at a point where we are looking to produce economic gas flows and likely to announce those in the next quarter.
Okay, so explain coal bed methane. How does that process work?
So you've got a coal seam underground. Generally, the coal seams for coal bed methane sit between 300 and 700 meters deep. In our case, they're about, we'll say, 600 meters deep. There's two different methods generally of extracting the gas from the coal. So in coal underground, you'll have the coal, obviously, but as part of that coal, there's water and gas sorbed to that coal. So you drill a vertical well into the coals. You extract, that depressurizes the coal under the ground. The water starts to flow from the coals, and with that water, there is some gas. As time goes on, you dewater the coals where a significant amount of water comes out first, then the level of gas increases and the level of water decreases. Then you measure that water and gas, particularly the gas. You separate them at a separator at the top of the wellhead, and you can evaporate the water, for instance. You can re-inject it. You can sell it to an off-taker if they're looking for water. And the gas from the other point of it, you send for processing, and that's what you generate your power from.
Okay, and you're in Botswana. Why Botswana specifically?
Well, Botswana, the reason we ended up there was on the back of a previous very successful venture in Australia, a company called Sunshine Gas. A number of our investors were very successful on that, and following on from that, they looked around the world for a basin that they saw as something similar to the success they had with Sunshine Gas. They looked in a number of countries. They settled in Botswana due to the good coal qualities that were in the region, the chronic demand for power in the region, and the potential to replace diesel-fired generation, which is seen as like a dirty fuel, and coal-fired generation, which is also seen as a dirty fuel. And the World Bank, for instance, doesn't fund coal-fired generation anymore. So this, we were able to replace those or provide power to those huge markets using a clean energy source.
Okay, so essentially, Botswana is you know, energy shortage, and they rely on a lot of imports there, and like I say, dirty material there. So you've got the marketplace there. I mean, and I'm looking there at the share register, and there are some chunky shareholders. And you've got JP Morgan there, you've got HSBC, you know, BNP Paribas, Citicorp Group. And
we have a very wide range of shareholders. Some very long-standing shareholders who have been with us since we started back in 2009. Very supportive, understand the project. We have a very supportive management team as well. And so the reality of it is we're very, very tightly held, which unfortunately may mean a little bit more difficult to get liquidity going in the market. But, you know, we're working towards a few good news stories in the next few months, which should change that.
Okay, so take us through what's happening then, timeline-wise. So at the moment, where are you at Lasardi there?
Right now at the Lasardi project, we're in process of gas flow testing. What that involves is flowing gas from one of our wells, measuring that level of gas. Then once we get to a sustained flow of gas, we will then increase the gas rate, build it up to a level where you get the optimum gas flow as per our reservoir engineers. We would then send all that information to our reserve certifiers, who would then assess that and book independently certified gas reserves from that data. Now, if we get that independently certified gas reserves, we will be the first company in Botswana to achieve that. The timeline for all of this is sustained gas flows we're expecting to happen in the next month or so. The optimum rate will follow on from that probably within a month. Then all that data is going to the reserve certifiers, who would likely give us reserve certification sometime in quarter two. So it's a big few months ahead for us, but something we're looking forward to. The other key point we have at the moment is we are in discussions with some parties in relation to signing an offtake agreement or a power purchase agreement for when we have the gas. Now, we're expecting some news flow on that to happen in the very near term. And by that, I mean in the next month to 2 months.
Okay. All right. All right. So you've got, I'm looking at, I usually use an acronym, which is CASH. And each letter obviously stands for a different thing. So the asset there, I'm seeing you've got contingent resources there of 3.3 trillion cubic feet. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Now, contingent resources signify that's, you know, an estimation of the gas in the ground. Mm-hmm. Converting that to reserves makes it, de-risks a lot further and suggests how much of it you can actually get from the ground and prove to be economic.
Okay, so that's the A of cash, Dan. We've done the S for shareholders, which is a very supportive group. They're tightly held. So C, it's always important to have cash. Now, do you have cash at the moment?
We have sufficient cash to do our current work program, which is to flow the gas, get our reserves certified, get our EIAs, our environmental impact assessment for field development. This is a key item. We submitted our EIA application last year. We're expecting to get a reply from the relevant department in Botswana in the next quarter, likely to be sort of end of April, early May. They should come back to us. There is the potential that that will then go for public consultation for a few months. At the end of that, on receipt of approval for our EIA, we then can apply to convert our current licenses, which are called prospecting or exploration licenses, to development licenses. At that point, we end up becoming rather than being an exploration company, essentially we're now in development or pre-development, if you wish. So that's a key item that's going to happen over the next few months, and we are fully funded to achieve all of those targets.
Okay, marvellous stuff. And the H in the CASH acronym goes to head honcho or management. So can you tell us a bit about the management, where you all come from?
The board is made up of four different members, including myself. I'm originally from Ireland, a bean counter who ended up in Island Gas in Australia, and I've relocated back to this side of the world again since we listed on AIM. Our MD is a gentleman by the name of Tony Gilby. Well, Tony is extremely successful, extremely well known in the industry, particularly in in Australia with his success from Sunshine Gas, which he took from a junior explorer to being sold to British Gas back in 2008 for $1.1 billion. That's about £600,000 or £600 million. So he's extremely successful. He's been there, done that, about 30 years experience, and a lot of people follow Tony for based on that success. He was also involved with Arrow Energy, another very successful Australian firm. One of the other key personnel we have is a gentleman by the name of Habake Habake. He's a Botswana resident director and the former permanent secretary with the Department of Mines, Energy and Water in Botswana. Now, the permanent secretary, for those who don't know, is essentially the person who's in line, next in line to the minister, so reports directly to the minister. Very well respected, very well connected person in Botswana and a key member of our team. The fourth member of our board is a gentleman by the name of Martin McIver. Martin has a long history working with mining services companies and has been on the board since inception back in 2009. So we have a very strong team. In addition to that, we have a number of consulting firms that we use, mainly based out of Brisbane, which really is a centre of coal bed methane development. Queensland is very strong on CBM. So we use a lot of consultants out there, particularly engineers and geologists and so forth.
Okay, and the Lesedi project there, how close is it? I mean, is it good infrastructure, or are you out in the back beyond, or what?
It's probably a bit of both. The project itself is actually located in the Kalahari Desert in central Botswana. Now, it sounds like it's the middle, being the desert, sounds like the middle of nowhere. Reality is we're about 80 to 100 k's away from the grid. Now, putting in a pipeline to connect to a grid, or putting poles and wires to connect to a grid for 80 kilometers through the desert is not a huge distance in the general scheme of things. And so, yes, there is that potential to connect to the grid. There is also the potential to provide power to a number of mines in the region. There are a lot of privately developed mines that are producing diamonds in Botswana. One of the key things about Botswana was it became independent in 1963, and in 1966 they discovered diamonds. The Orapa diamond mine, for instance, in Botswana is one of the biggest mines in the world, and the Botswana government are extremely supportive, and they're very forward thinking, and they understand that the royalties they receive from diamond mines are not going to last forever. That revenue is going to deplete. They're looking to get other industries in play that will allow them to have sufficient revenue to replace that depleted diamond royalty revenue, and one of those industries is the export power market, of which we would be part of.
Okay. So if all things go well, Colin, I don't know if you can answer this in any way, but ideally, revenue-wise, what are you looking at when you're up and running there? What are you thinking about?
Look, it's a difficult figure to announce at this stage. What I will say is, at the moment, we are planning a 10-megawatt proof-of-concept project where we will provide 10 megawatts of power into the grid. That will likely be a scalable project, up to maybe 50 megawatts, and following on from that, then there are other opportunities to provide gas to the Orapa power station, potentially larger projects like 300 megawatt independent power projects, and even export power. So the key thing I think about it is, because we're starting off with in an oil and gas terms, a relatively small 10 megawatt project, that can generate revenue from us. We can use that 10 megawatt revenue to continually develop the project, and it's scalable rather than having to inject a whole heap of funds up front to develop one massive project.
Okay, well, you can give us loads of information there, Colin. But as a sort of roundup, if you could you give me three reasons why an investor should put TLU or CLO Energy on their watch list, please?
Well, we are the most advanced CBM project in Botswana. We have very close links to the government, and we expect to get the project underway, all going to plan. Within 24 months, we will have gas into the market. That's subject to a number of items, particularly EIAs. The fact that we have a scalable project means that once we get our 10 megawatt plant up and running, we're now generating revenue. We can reinject that revenue into the company to develop the project further, which means we don't continually have to go back to shareholders asking for money. Then we're also in an area with a huge energy shortage, with phenomenal demand, particularly not only in Botswana, but particularly into the neighboring countries. And we have very supportive government, and the infrastructure is all also there to for us to achieve our goals.
Marvellous. Well, thanks very much, Colin, for coming on. And it's quite an exciting couple of years ahead of you, you've got. So listen, I assume you'll be releasing some more news in the not-too-distant future. So please, you know, come on and chat some more when that comes out.
I will indeed. Thank you very much.
That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, 4:30 Thursday, today. Submissions close for the All Price Sweepstake guesses. All right, so get your guess in before 4:30. What will the close be at Brent price, All Price, 12 o'clock tomorrow, midday? That's where we take the price from. If your guess is spot on, you win about $240, because it's 201 from last week. It's a rollover. It's a sextuple rollover. So plus whatever it will be at midday and Friday. Go to voxmarkets.co.uk/OPS. You have to submit your guess before, I say guess, what I mean is guess, before 4:30 Thursday, and you can win free money. It doesn't get better than that, does it? Free money. It's like free food. It's my favourite meal, free food. Whenever you go somewhere, in fact, big Gibbs event in March, free food and drink. It doesn't get better than that, does it? Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.